protesters in Bangladesh clashed with police as anti-government protests continued.
Police fired tear gas and lobbed stun grenades as tens of thousands of protesters took to the streets, calling for Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina to resign.
Plus, U.S. warships and fighter jets are on their way to the Middle East to deter conflict.
While simultaneously we are working very hard to de-escalate this situation diplomatically, because we do not believe that a regional war is in anyone's interest.
And how a race in Thailand marks the start of rice harvesting season. Today is Monday, August 5th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Good morning. I'm Steve Miller. Nearly 100 people have been killed and hundreds more were injured as renewed anti-government protests swept across Bangladesh. Protesters continue their call for the Prime Minister to resign as Sheikh Hasina accuses them of sabotage and cuts off mobile internet in a bid to quell the unrest. Reuters' Lauren Anthony begins our coverage.
Dozens of people have been killed and scores were injured in clashes in Bangladesh on Sunday. Police fired tear gas and lobbed stun grenades as tens of thousands of protesters took to the streets, calling for Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina to resign.
All the ministers are in hiding. Wait and see how the people will go and surround the Prime Minister's house. If Sheikh Hasina doesn't resign voluntarily, we will take our next step.
The Interior Ministry declared an indefinite nationwide curfew starting at 6 p.m. local time on Sunday. It's the first time it has taken such a step during the current protests, which began last month. The unrest is the government's biggest test since deadly protests erupted after Hasina won a fourth straight term in January elections that were boycotted by the main opposition Bangladesh Nationalist Party. Critics of Hasina, along with human rights groups, have accused her government of using excessive force to stamp out the movement, a charge she and her ministers deny. Demonstrators blocked major highways on Sunday as student protesters launched a non-cooperation program to press for the government's resignation. After a national security panel meeting, Hasina said those protesting were, quote, not students but terrorists who are out to destabilize the nation. For the second time during the recent protests, the government shut down high-speed internet services, mobile operators said. Some social media platforms were also unavailable. Last month, at least 150 people were killed and thousands more were injured and arrested in violence sparked by demonstrations led by student groups protesting against quotas for government jobs. The protests paused after the Supreme Court scrapped most quotas. The students sporadically returned to the streets last week, demanding justice for the families of those killed.
Lauren Anthony of Reuters News. Now switching to the Middle East, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on Sunday blamed Hamas for a long-stalled deal to end the war in Gaza and release Israeli hostages. Speaking at his weekly cabinet meeting, Netanyahu says Hamas has not agreed to basic terms of the ceasefire outline. Meanwhile, cross-border fire between Israel and Hamas, a U.S.-designated terrorist organization that controls the Gaza Strip, continued on Sunday after diplomatic efforts in Cairo on Saturday ended without progress. Israeli authorities also say a Palestinian attacker killed two people and wounded two others in a stabbing spree in central Israel before being shot dead by police. In addition, the Palestinian official news agency says an Israeli airstrike hit two schools in Gaza City, killing at least 25, while the Israeli military said it struck a Hamas military compound embedded in the schools. VOA, however, cannot independently verify either claim. And footage circulated on Palestinian media shows bodies scattered inside the yard of one of the two blast-wrecked schools as residents rushed to carry casualties, including children, and loaded them onto ambulances that took them to at least two nearby hospitals. It all comes as the United States, Western partners, and Jordan are telling their citizens to leave Lebanon. As Washington deploys additional military to the Middle East, imposturing, the White House describes as defensive, amid fears of an Iranian military strike on Israel. VOA's Arash Arabasadi takes it from here.
U.S. warships and fighter jets are on their way to the Middle East to deter an all-out war and, in quote, defense of Israel. White House Deputy National Security Advisor John Finer speaking Sunday on ABC's This Week as provided by the social media platform X.
Pentagon is moving significant assets to the region to prepare for what may be another need to defend Israel from an attack. While simultaneously, we are working very hard to de-escalate this situation diplomatically, because we do not believe that a regional war is in anyone's interest in the current moment. And that is something that we've been trying to avoid since October 7th.
The show of military might comes amid rapidly soaring tensions in the region following the assassination of top Hamas leader Ismail Haniyeh in Tehran last week, and a rocket strike on Israel's Golan Heights area that killed a dozen children on a soccer field days before. Israel blamed the Lebanese militant group Hezbollah for the attack and struck what it said were Hezbollah targets in Lebanon. A Hezbollah commander was killed. Both Hamas and Hezbollah are backed by Iran. Israeli military spokesperson Rear Admiral Daniel Hagari speaking on an IDF feed as provided by the Associated Press.
Hezbollah's ongoing aggression and brutal attacks are dragging the people of Lebanon and the entire Middle East into a wider escalation. While we prefer to resolve hostilities without a wider war, the IDF is fully prepared for any scenario.
But in Beirut, on footage carried by the Hezbollah-controlled Al-Manar TV, Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah denied the group's involvement.
We categorically deny our responsibility of this incident, and we have the courage to take responsibility if we bomb the place, even by mistake.
Despite the finger-pointing, there are real-world consequences for people living in the region. Israel's Iron Dome air defense system triggered over the weekend to intercept attacks from across the border in Lebanon. And with military reinforcements on the way, the State Department issued a do-not-travel advisory for Lebanon, encouraging U.S. citizens to depart. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
We're also following these stories from around the world. Voices across the globe are expressing concern over the growing number of arrests in Venezuela following last weekend's disputed elections. A U.S. official said Sunday the Biden administration is concerned about the possibility of political instability if the arrests continue. Some nations, including the United States and Argentina, have already recognized opposition candidate Edmundo Gonzalez as the election's winner over incumbent President Nicolas Maduro. Nigeria's leader has called for an end to mass protests over economic hardship, saying the rallies have turned violent, blaming a few with a political agenda for driving them. Amnesty International has reported the deaths of 9 protesters in clashes with police, while another 4 were killed by a bomb. The Nigerian police denied the amnesty report. British Prime Minister Keir Starmer strongly condemned an attack Sunday on a hotel housing asylum seekers that saw at least 10 police officers injured. At least one officer was seriously injured. Starmer described the attack as far-right thuggery. Starmer was speaking after another day of far-right violence, which was particularly acute in the north of England town of Rotterdam, where police struggled to hold back hundreds of rioters who sought to break into a Holiday Inn Express hotel. And now to India's northern Uttarakhand state. Pushkar Singh Dami, the state chief, told reporters that emergency workers deployed in different parts of the Himalayan region rescued at least 17,000 pilgrims who were stranded after torrential rains hit that area. Prone to flash floods and landslides, Uttarakhand reported 11 deaths after a massive cloudburst pounded the region, hampering communications in the hilly terrain. Rescuers were seen airlifting survivors using helicopters in the district of Sunprayag, while thousands of Hindu devotees on the pilgrimage remain missing. In the neighboring state of Himachal Pradesh, Rescue teams search for over 40 missing people after the cloudburst triggered landslides and flooding in the region. And still coming up later in the program, why one former professional tennis star joined the military.
Because if Ukraine falls, Europe might see this at home.
This is VOA News. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Experts have confirmed famine is ongoing in the North Darfur area of Sudan and say starvation is likely occurring in other parts of the country. Baird Alexander is the Mercy Corps Director of Programs for Sudan. He tells VOA's Carol Van Dam that last week's report by the Famine Early Warning Systems Network highlights the dire situation for tens of thousands of Sudanese trapped by a war waged between two competing military factions.
I think because of the recent, not only recent, but historically present politics around declaring famine, we don't necessarily expect that a formal declaration will follow this review unless there's tremendous international pressure. The FRC report also confirms that famine is likely happening in other parts of Sudan, namely the rest of the Darfur states, central, southwest Darfur, and north-south Kordofan, Al Jazeera state, and parts of Khartoum.
Now, everybody knows about the conflict, and it's been going on for over a year, but why is it hitting Darfur, the famine, I mean, the famine alert in this area and other areas near there so much?
Yeah, the FRC confirmation essentially tells us that the longstanding roadblocks to getting aid into parts of Darfur, particularly North Darfur, with the obstruction of aid getting across the Chad-Sudan border, delays in travel permissions by authorities in Darfur, ongoing conflict, you name it. Now the rainy season is happening in Darfur, so there's continued to be limited access. Those are the reasons that put us in this dire situation.
When you get into Al-Fashir and those areas, who is blocking the entry points for these aid workers to get in?
It's not only in Darfur. This is a Sudan-wide problem that we're seeing across both parties to conflict, where access across front lines, across borders, is being withheld. Even access, particularly in the recent fighting around Sennar State, that displaced 150,000 households to east towards Gedaref and Kassala. Access to those areas in Sennar and Jazeera State, across line into South Kordofan and North Kordofan, have been impeded over the last year as well. There are mutual obstructions from both parties to conflict.
Are your aid workers at risk, the ones that are working in those kinds of areas?
Well, Mercy Corps is not operational in North Darfur around Al-Fashir. We have heard other NGO reports, local partners on the ground, MSF, other partners of ours that are having difficulties with staff safety. Regardless of where in the country, staff safety and humanitarian worker safety is an issue. We're seeing that across the board as attacks on aid workers is a persistent problem. We saw that with the recent pullout of MSF from the hospital in Khartoum, and we continue to see that across the various conflict zones in Sudan.
A report mentions the Zamzam camp specifically for internally displaced persons. Can you talk about that a little?
Our report focuses mainly on Central and South Darfur, so not in the Zamzam camp area. However, the Famine Review Committee were the ones that provided the assessment on Zamzam camp conditions and found that famine conditions are likely for about 500,000 people. In the report that we released a couple weeks ago, we found that in Central Darfur, over 4,100 children were screened, and about a quarter of them were found to have severe acute malnutrition, which is the most severe and life-threatening type of hunger. And another 2,800 children, or two-thirds of those screened, were found to have moderate acute malnutrition.
That was the Sudan Director of Programs for Mercy Corps, Barrett Alexander, speaking to VOA's Carol Van Dam. Now, in the United States, U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris is interviewing three more possible Democratic vice presidential running mates on Sunday. And one could soon make a choice on who would join her in running against Republican former President Donald Trump and his number two, Ohio Senator J.D. Vance, in the November election. Meanwhile, Trump says that he's pulling out of a scheduled September debate with Harris on the ABC broadcast network and wants them to face off on Fox News. The AP's Jackie Quinn has that story.
In a social media post, former President Donald Trump says he agreed to a debate with President Biden on ABC, not with Kamala Harris. And earlier in the week, inserted a dig against her at a black journalist convention.
You know what? She failed her law exam. She didn't pass her law exam, so maybe she wouldn't pass the cognitive test.
Also Wednesday, Vice President Harris challenged him to keep the September date. These differing plans, though, seem to make it increasingly unlikely the candidates will confront one another face-to-face before the November election. I'm Jackie Quinn.
So while the status of the debates may not yet be known, White House Bureau Chief Patsy Wiedekuswar shares more on what is known about the foreign policies of Vice President Harris leading up to the election.
Thousands of Central American migrants cross Mexico every year heading for the U.S. border. Coordinating with the region to address the root causes of migration was a task assigned to Vice President Kamala Harris, leaving her open to attacks from her November rival, former President Donald Trump.
She was a bum, a failed vice president and a failed administration with millions of people crossing, and she was the border czar.
Harris is not the administration's border czar, but on immigration, she brings a tough message to the campaign trail, highlighting her experience as California's attorney general.
I went after transnational gangs, drug cartels, and human traffickers that came into our country illegally. I prosecuted them in case after case, and I won. Donald Trump, on the other hand, has been talking a big game about securing our border, but he does not walk the walk.
If elected, Harris said she'll bring back President Joe Biden's border bill that was killed by pro-Trump Republicans in Congress. She'd continue his efforts to help Ukraine while preventing direct war with Russia and work to maintain unity among NATO allies. Also expect continuity in the Indo-Pacific.
The United States stands with the Philippines in the face of intimidation and coercion in the South China Sea.
And on trade with China. Robert Daly, director of the Wilson Center's Kissinger Institute on China and the U.S., via Skype.
She will continue, as she has said, to try to de-risk from China. We know that when she ran for president in 2020, she was fairly tariff-averse, like President Biden. She seems to have changed her mind about that. So more continuity than otherwise.
On Gaza, Harris is aligned with Biden, aiming for a ceasefire and preventing a regional war. However, with a large swath of the Democratic electorate angry at Biden's staunch support for Israel, Harris appears to be much more sympathetic to Palestinian casualties.
We cannot allow ourselves to become numb to the suffering, and I will not be silent.
Harris has embraced the Biden doctrine of leading by relying on allies and partners and has focused on non-traditional security threats, chairing the National Space Council and promoting the administration's policies on artificial intelligence and climate. Linda Robinson, Senior Fellow for Women and Foreign Policy at the Council on Foreign Relations via Skype.
So when people say, oh, she just had the immigration portfolio and we have a terrible immigration problem, they aren't really encompassing the full role that she's played in every region of the world.
Despite her almost 4 years of traveling the globe, meeting 150 heads of state and government, Trump says Harris is inexperienced and unaccomplished.
She is a radical left lunatic who will destroy our country.
Her response?
If you got something to say, say it to my face.
Patsy Wiedekuswara, VOA News at the White House.
Sunday in Europe, Ukraine's newly arrived F-16 fighter jets were put on display by Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky.
I can't for today give you details with the missions. I think you will see, maybe not all of them, but you will see the result.
He added that the planes will boost the country's war effort against Russia. Now, although they are new to Ukraine, the F-16s are actually older jets that have been donated by Western allies. Belgium, Denmark, the Netherlands, and Norway have all committed to providing Ukraine with more than 60 of them over the next few months. But fighter jets are not the only Ukrainian weapons in the sky. Anna Kostachenko brings us that part of the story.
35-year-old retired Ukrainian tennis star Alex Dolgopolov has been fighting on the front lines since the early months of Russia's invasion, and he says he has never regretted this decision.
I don't think we need a motivation because it's our homeland. First, I was helping more with the media, collecting some money, training a little bit. After, step by step, I joined, and I felt I had to do more. You know, it's always in the back of your head when you're doing this, and you're like, oh, someone's fighting now, and you're like a healthy sports person. You could also help with something.
Dolgopolov started playing tennis at age 3. He has won 3 singles and 1 doubles tournament and ranked 13 in the world for singles in January of 2012. Dolgopolov earned over $7 million in prize money before retiring from professional tennis in 2021. But when Russia invaded Ukraine in early 2022, he became a drone operator with Ukraine's armed forces.
Because if Ukraine falls, Europe might see this at home.
Dolgopolov says on the front lines, a drone operator's shift can last for hours.
If you just gather information, you can come and work 7 hours. If it's an assault and you have to help your guys on the ground, then it usually was like 15 hours. And you can't stop because there's people who depend on you.
Dolgopolov says his 15 years in professional sports helps him cope with daily wartime stress.
Many people say sport is a war, just without killing. So you fight in extreme conditions. You have to overcome very tough situations, sometimes injuries and playing with injuries, training really hard. So your mentality is always in stress and fighting the stress.
Dolgopolov hopes to use his experience in professional sports to develop specialized physical training for Ukrainian soldiers.
The army is quite a big mechanism. I believe it has a very general physical training. I think we can improve that. Well, NATO training is good, but first of all, we don't have that time. Second of all, we don't have the resources that NATO has. I believe they have much better rotations, much more rest. They have more time in training. They have time to work on their physics on the rotation. So we don't have those things.
Dolgopolov was working on a program designed to strengthen the spine and knee joints while enhancing the endurance of Ukrainian fighters. Anna Kostyuchenko, VOA News, Central Ukraine.
And finally, Thai farmers raised water buffaloes on Sunday to herald the start of the rice cultivation season. A government official tells Reuters News that the race serves as a reminder of the buffalo's historical role in agriculture dating back to the 1800s, before the region shifted to more industrialized practices. Over 50 buffaloes competed along a 200-meter muddy track in the Napa sub-district of the Chonburi province. That's located about 80 kilometers southeast of Bangkok. And during the competition, racers took pairs of buffaloes equipped with plowing gear to the starting track, and then the officials signaled the start. Well, this has been International Edition on the Voice of America, and on behalf of everyone here at VOA, we thank you for joining us. For pictures, videos, stories, and more, be sure to follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform, and of course, online at voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller.